Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Book Network podcast. I am Deidre Tyler, host of the channel. Today we'll be talking with Professor Chad L. Williams, the author of The Wounded World, W.E.B. Du Bois, and the First World War. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Professor Williams, I wonder if you could start by saying a few words about yourself and how you got started on this project.
Well, I'm a professor of African American Studies and History at Brandeis University. My first book, Torchbearers of Democracy, African American Soldiers in the World War I Era, examined the history of African Americans during the war and their struggles for democracy and citizenship. And this book really came out of that project and actually going back to my doctoral dissertation, which would become Torchbearers of Democracy. I was doing research at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and I saw a curious reference to Du Bois' World War I materials. And I quite honestly didn't know what to expect. I thought it might be interesting to look at this collection. So I go to the library, I ask the librarian to see this collection, and she returns with 6 microfilm reels. So I'm really interested in what is on these microfilm reels. I load the first reel and I discover this manuscript, this 800-page manuscript by W.E.B. Du Bois on the Black experience in World War I that he never finished and was ultimately never published. In addition to that, all of Du Bois's research materials and correspondence related to this project that he devoted 20 years to working on. So from that moment, I was hooked. I was obsessed with learning more about this book, learning more about why it was never completed, but ultimately what it could potentially tell us about W.B. Du Bois himself, his life, his work, and his political and intellectual evolution as it relates to the broader struggles for freedom and democracy for Black people in the 20th century.
Chapter 1, you started by telling us something about his family, August 1914. Tell us more.
Du Bois, really from the start of the war, had a very close, intimate, personal connection to the conflict. His daughter and his wife were traveling to Europe during the initial month of the war in August of 1914. His daughter was going to boarding school. His wife was going to accompany her. So he was concerned about their safety, concerned about how the war would affect them. Ultimately, they do travel to Europe and spend the first year of the war overseas. But this was really the beginning of Du Bois's very close connection to the war and ultimately how he would wrestle with its significance, both on a personal, intellectual level, as well as on a deeper political level as well.
Now, tell us about Du Bois' education, the region of the country in which he was born, and something about his mother. How did that, push him into being who he was.
Du Bois lived a truly remarkable life, 95 years, and he was born in Great Barrington, Massachusetts in 1868, during the Reconstruction years, during the years when Andrew Johnson was president of the United States. And he grew up in a very small New England community, which did have a very vibrant, a very small, but still nevertheless vibrant Black community. And his mother was part of that Black community, which went back several generations. And he was very close to his mother. His father left the family at a very young age. And he felt that it was his responsibility to certainly take care of his mother. And after she died very prematurely, to fulfill the promises that he made to her to receive the best education possible and to represent his race as best as he could.
Now, he had many different jobs within the academic world. Tell us something about his academic life.
Du Bois was truly singular in terms of his education, in terms of his pedigree. He received his first undergraduate degree from Fisk University. It was his first time traveling to the South, where he really began to see himself as African-American, as part of a proud race of people. But he always desired, as most New England boys did, to receive a Harvard education. So he was admitted to Harvard to pursue a second undergraduate degree. And then from there, he continued into graduate school at Harvard, where he would ultimately become the first African-American to receive a PhD from Harvard University. During this time, he also studied for 2 years at the University of Berlin, which was considered to be the pinnacle of higher education in the late 19th century. So his educational background was really unparalleled in terms of African Americans and peoples of African descent more broadly in the late 19th century, at a time when the vast majority of African Americans were being relegated to second-class citizenship and did not have educational opportunities.
The death of Dr. Du Bois' son, tell us about that and how that impacted the family.
And very tragically, Du Bois' firstborn son, Burkhart, died less than 2 years old when the family was living in Atlanta. Du Bois first taught at Wilberforce, and then took a position at Atlanta University, where he really established himself as the leading scholar and intellectual of African-American studies at the time. And the death of his son was deeply impactful for Du Bois, especially for his wife, who really never recovered from the trauma. But that really symbolized for Du Bois the challenges of being Black in America, that even despite his educational background, despite all of his success, he was still vulnerable to the pain, the suffering, the death that was so endemic to Black people in the late 19th century, and especially in the South.
Now, let's move to the war. What was Du Bois' warning to the Black population about the importance of the war?
Really, from the start of the war, Du Bois implored African Americans to realize the significance of the war, not just to their lives, but to the lives and futures of peoples of African descent more broadly. He was incredibly clairvoyant, incredibly prescient in identifying the root causes of the war and the colonial exploitation of African peoples. How the desire for colonies amongst the European belligerents for the human and material resources in Africa fueled the rivalries and conflicts which ultimately led to the war. And he believed that it was important for African Americans to realize what was going on and to understand that the destinies of peoples of African descent were also tied to their destinies as well.
When Booker T. Washington died in 1915, how did Du Bois move into the spotlight?
Booker T. Washington was considered to be the spokesman of the race. He was the powerful principal of the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. He wielded incredible influence and power. He had a very volatile relationship with W.E.B. Du Bois, and their rivalry really reflected the debates about which course of action was most appropriate for African Americans, particularly by the turn of the century. When Booker T. Washington dies in 1915, it leaves a tremendous void in terms of African American leadership, which Du Bois readily fills. So by the time of the war in 1914, and certainly by 1915, when Booker T. Washington dies, Du Bois has firmly established himself as the leading spokesperson of the race.
Now, you talk about in Chapter 1, Du Bois meeting Adam Patterson. Tell us about that connection.
Adam Patterson is really a fascinating figure. He was someone who believed that it was possible to succeed regardless of race in America at a time when African Americans were being relegated to second-class citizens and essentially removed from the political establishment. He makes a very controversial decision to align himself with the Democratic Party and with the administration of Woodrow Wilson. And he's heavily criticized for this, criticized by many African Americans in the press, including W.E.B. Du Bois. They reunite, interestingly enough, during the war when Adam Patterson receives a commission to become an officer in the United States Army. He eventually becomes one of the highest ranking officers in the United States Army, achieving the rank of major. And Adam Patterson and Du Bois meet for the first time in France immediately after the war, when Du Bois travels to France to begin conducting research for what he envisioned would be his book on the Black experience in the war. He meets Adam Patterson, and Patterson is also interested in helping Du Bois with this book. And they form a very close relationship, but a relationship that eventually becomes increasingly complicated over the post-war years, and as I talk about in the book, becomes increasingly bitter as well.
Now, you talk about another famous person, Charles Young, Colonel Charles Young. Can you tell us about his connection with Dr. Du Bois?
Colonel Charles Young was arguably W.B. Du Bois' closest Black friend. As I write about in the book, they had a very close personal relationship going back to the time that they spent together at Wilberforce. Colonel Charles Young was the most decorated and highest ranking Black officer in the United States Army. He was considered Black America's war hero. I guess the best analogy would be with Colin Powell. He was essentially Black America's Colin Powell before there was a Colin Powell. And Charles Young embodied for Du Bois the potential of African Americans to be fully 100% American citizens. As Du Bois writes about in his classic book, The Souls of Black Folk, African Americans faced a sense of double consciousness in terms of their identity, this sense of being Black on the one hand and being American on the other. And the tension, the two warring ideals that came along with being Black and being American. In the personhood of Colonel Charles Young, his close friend, Du Bois believed that it was indeed possible for African Americans to be both Black and be American at the same time.
Now, you brought to our attention that this time period that you're talking about, there were lots of riots, 1917 East St. Louis riot, Houston, Texas. All of these events, Du Bois was a part of it, so he was also a scholar and an activist. Can you tell us about that?
When the United States enters the war, Du Bois makes the very difficult decision to support the United States and the Allied war effort. He believes that the war is going to be an opportunity for African Americans to demonstrate their citizenship and, as a result, achieve greater citizenship and democratic rights. But his faith in his commitment to supporting the war is very quickly tested during the early years, during the first year that the United States enters the conflict in 1917. In July of 1917, there's a horrific race riot, racial massacre in East St. Louis. Shortly after that, Black soldiers in Houston, Texas, engage in a bloody mutiny. So while Du Bois is still committed to supporting the war, to supporting her his country, he also has to contend with the ongoing realities of violent white supremacy.
Now, you talk about the Black soldiers' experience in France and what Dr. Du Bois found. Give us some stories about that.
After the end of the war, Du Bois is in a very precarious place. He's written a very controversial article for The Crisis entitled Close Ranks, where he encourages African Americans to set aside their special grievances and close ranks with their fellow white Americans and their allies. And he's heavily criticized for this. His harshest critics accuse him of abandoning the cause of the race, of essentially being a traitor. And after the war, he's wounded by this criticism. And he uses the writing of the war and investigating the experiences of Black soldiers in the war as an opportunity to demonstrate his continued leadership and to essentially rehabilitate his image. He goes to France immediately after the armistice, and he begins to talk with Black soldiers and officers in France about their experiences. And he hears directly from their mouths the horrific racial discrimination that they received in the United States Army, which was completely segregated, which believed that the majority of Black soldiers should be relegated to laborers, who believed that Black officers had no place in the Army, who saw them as uppity, stepping outside of the racial hierarchy of the United States, of being obsessed with chasing after white French women. So he hears all these horrible stories about American racism being transported to France. And he internalizes all this, and he uses this as motivation to ultimately write the history of the war.
Chapter 3, you talk about the 360th Infantry, and you talk about the confusion, the mistrust, and what was going on, and how they were, the African-American soldiers were blamed unfairly. And during that time, 42 men were killed and 284 wounded. Tell us more about that incident.
So one of the most controversial regiments of Black soldiers was the 368th Infantry Regiment. And they engaged in the Meuse-Argonne Offensive in September of 1918, the main offensive of the Allies, which would ultimately turn the tide of the war. And during this battle, they were accused of cowardice, accused of being failures on the battlefield. The Black officers of this regiment were accused of essentially disobeying orders and being worthless in terms of their leadership. The other regiments of this division, the All-Black 92nd Division, believed that it was important for them to reclaim the reputation of the regiment. And they were fighting literally on the last day of the war, November the 11th, and proved their worth, all the while taking heavy casualties, which proved tactically worthless, but were still nevertheless very symbolic. Du Bois, when he travels to France, he talks to many of the men who were in the 368th Infantry Regiment and other men who were part of the 92nd Division more broadly. And he learns about their experiences, the triumphs, the incredible courage that they exhibited, but also the racism and discrimination that they experienced. And he really develops a sense for the rage, the bitterness that many Black soldiers and Black officers in particular had based on their experiences in the war.
You also talk about the fact that Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois had a different relationship with President Wilson. The first stage of the relationship and the latter stage, did Dr. Du Bois see this as a time to connect and have a racial advancement?
Du Bois had a very interesting relationship with Woodrow Wilson. He initially supported Woodrow Wilson's presidency in 1912, when Woodrow Wilson initially ran for president. Very controversially, the majority of African Americans continued to support the Republican Party. Du Bois believed that in supporting Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat, that it would potentially usher in a new era of race relations, that even though Wilson was a native Southerner, that he was not rabidly racist, like many white politicians were at the time. But Du Bois would very quickly be disappointed in Woodrow Wilson, who was firmly committed to white supremacy. He segregated the federal bureaucracy. He screened Birth of a Nation, the vilely racist 1915 blockbuster film, in the White House. And Du Bois lost faith in Woodrow Wilson, particularly as it related to race relations and African Americans. But even considering that, when the United States enters the war and Woodrow Wilson proclaims that the United States is going to be fighting to make the world safe for democracy, Du Bois is enraptured by the democratic potential of the war. And he sees the war as an opportunity to advance democracy for Black people in the United States, as well as throughout the broader African diaspora.
Chapter 3. You talked about Du Bois and the proposed book about Blacks in the War. Tell us about the process.
The genesis for Du Bois' book on the Black experience in the war began in October of 1918, just before the armistice ending the war. The NAACP Board of Directors essentially tasked Du Bois with writing about the Black experience in the war, and Du Bois leaps at the opportunity to do so. This is the scholar in Du Bois, intrigued by the possibility of writing another book, but he also sees this as an opportunity to demonstrate his leadership and to establish himself as the definitive spokesperson for Black soldiers during and certainly after the war. So he begins to immediately work on this book. It runs into a whole host of complications, as I talk about in my book, but he remains committed to it. As I said, he travels to France after the armistice, spends 3 months essentially beginning his research for the book. He also establishes very close relationships with Black soldiers and officers who began to give him materials to use in the book: letters, diaries, official military documents, photographs, an incredible archive of primary source materials that Du Bois begins to amass, which is going to serve as the foundation for what he believes is going to be the definitive history of the war.
Chapter 4. What was Du Bois' trip like to France?
Du Bois' trip to France in late 1918 and early 19 was one of the defining moments of his life. He believed that it was in France where, as he wrote, the destinies of mankind were centered. Right? He travels aboard the official press ship accompanying President Woodrow Wilson to the peace conference. He organizes a landmark Pan-African Congress in February of 1919. But his principal mission, as he described it, was to begin research for his book, to investigate the conditions facing African-American soldiers and officers in France during the war. And it's these experiences of talking directly with Black soldiers, of seeing with his own eyes the devastation of the war, right? The battlefields, of actually being in the trenches, where the war becomes very real for him. And he internalizes that, and he carries that with him back to the United States as he begins further work on his book. And really, that experience in France would stay with Du Bois throughout the rest of his life.
Now, you talk about the Pan-Africa Congress. How did he start that during his trip, or tell us more about that?
Du Bois was always very committed to the cause of Pan-Africanism. He actually attended and was the secretary for the first Pan-African Congress, which was held in 1900 in London, organized by Henry Sylvester Williams. So the opportunity to organize another Pan-African Congress was very intriguing for Du Bois. He believed that the war presented an opportunity to essentially address the problem of European colonialism as it related specifically to Africa. And he wanted to use the peace conference as an opportunity to lobby the European powers, the United States as well, to take the rights and future of Africa and African peoples seriously. And his organization of the Pan-African Congress in February of 1919 was his first step in doing that. It was relatively small, but still very important in laying a foundation for future Pan-African Congresses and ultimately for future movements for African liberation and decolonization that would materialize by the late 1940s and into the 1950s.
You mentioned that Du Bois spoke all over the country about the war, and specifically he went to Chicago. Tell us about that Chicago trip.
When Du Bois returns back to the United States in March of 1919, he is incredibly motivated to reestablish his leadership stature and to inform the African-American public about his findings in France. So he goes on a speaking tour, travels to numerous cities, Chicago being one of them. And his time in Chicago was very important, especially considering that Chicago had become really the hub of the Great Migration, African-Americans migrating from the South to the North during the years of the war, and Chicago being one of the primary destinations. So his speech before a huge audience in Chicago was incredibly important for Du Bois to demonstrate that he remained one of, if not the leading spokesman of the race, but to also gain the support of African Americans who were committed to staking out freedom and new opportunities in that city in particular.
Red Summer, 1919. How did Du Bois look at that situation, and what was the response of President Wilson?
Du Bois returns to the United States along with Black soldiers to a nation in turmoil, to a nation that is responding to the democratic hopes and aspirations of Black people and Black soldiers in particular with violence and bloodshed. Du Bois's colleague, James Weldon Johnson, labeled the bloody months of the summer of 1919 the Red Summer because of the race riots that took place in cities like Chicago, cities like Washington, D.C., the racial massacres that occurred throughout the South, in states like Arkansas, the violence inflicted upon returning Black soldiers, many of whom were assaulted, many of whom were lynched, some still wearing their uniforms. Du Bois was astonished by the scale and scope of the violence in the summer of 1919, and it further deepened his growing disillusionment with the outcomes of the war. Du Bois, keep in mind, believed that the war was going to be a transformative moment in democracy in the United States and elsewhere, that African Americans would have greater citizenship rights, that their humanity would be respected. And the Red Summer of 1919 very painfully demonstrated that that was not the case. And Du Bois had to reckon with the horror of that moment, but also what it meant for his support for the war, which was becoming increasingly problematic to justify.
Charles Young retired. Dr. Du Bois was connected with him. How did he help him through this retirement?
Charles Young had aspirations to be a general in the war. He viewed the war as potentially the crowning moment of his career. And he was, in fact, in line to be promoted to a general. But the embedded racism of the United States Army would not allow that to happen. He had some health concerns, and the Army very conveniently used those as a pretext to prematurely retire him from active service. And this really broke Charles Young's heart. It was incredibly disappointing, and Du Bois, being his close friend, knew all too well how painful it was for Charles Young to not have the opportunity to serve his country in what was considered to be the greatest conflict in American and quite possibly world history. Du Bois advocated for him to be reinstated with no success, but continued to fight for him even after the war. When the war came to an end, Charles Young very conveniently was reinstated into active duty by the United States Army. However, he decided to serve in Africa, in Liberia. And very tragically, he died in Africa in 1922, a death that Du Bois felt on a very deep personal level.
Now, Dr. Du Bois had a Brownie book. What was this to serve as? What was this all about?
The Brownie book was one of Du Bois's many, many ideas. He was always very intellectually active and adventurous and creative. The Brownies book was a children's magazine that he established in 1920, which was designed to educate children about different events taking place in the United States and the Black world as it related to Black people, but to also inspire them and to demonstrate the beauty of Black childhood at a time when Black children were not being respected by white America, both in terms of their symbolic cultural representations, but also in terms of their very lives as well. So the Brownie book was very important. Du Bois, even though it only lasted for a year, looked back at the Brownie book as one of his most important accomplishments.
1921, the Tulsa race riots. How did Dr. Du Bois respond to that?
The Tulsa race riot was just one of many horrific race riots and massacres that took place in the post-war period. It was devastating in terms of the scope and scale of the violence. The very prosperous Greenwood community of Tulsa was literally burned to the ground. Du Bois, like most African Americans, was shocked, appalled by the violence. But at the time, he was organizing another Pan-African Congress, which would be held in Europe in 1921. So he was really wrapped up in the organization and preparations for his Pan-African Congress, and didn't say much publicly about the horror of the Tulsa massacre. But he was certainly aware of it, and it was just another stark reminder of how the hopes that he had for the war were not materializing.
The mistrust of other Black scholars and Dr. Du Bois, what was going on there?
Du Bois had very contentious relationships with a number of other Black scholars. Du Bois had a very outsized ego, and he believed that there were few people, if anyone, who was smarter, more qualified than him, especially when it came to writing the history of the Black experience in the war. He initially tries to co-author his book with Carter G. Woodson, the founder of the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, who also held a PhD in history from Harvard University, as well as with Emmett J. Scott, who was Booker T. Washington's former secretary at the Tuskegee Institute, who served as a special assistant to the Secretary of War in the War Department during the war and held tremendous influence, especially as related to relationships and official records concerning Black soldiers and their experiences. But his attempts to work with Carter G. Woodson and Emmett Scott ultimately failed because of egos, but also because Emmett J. Scott in particular had intentions to write his own book on the history of the war. And this became a very heated rivalry that would carry on throughout the interwar period.
Now, moving down, Dr. E.B. Du Bois, how did he feel about Marcus Garvey and his movement?
Marcus Garvey was the leader, organizer of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. It would become the largest global organization for Black people in the aftermath of the war. Du Bois initially didn't think much of Marcus Garvey, but as the UNIA grew in size, as Marcus Garvey grew in leadership stature, he began to take him much more seriously. And ultimately, he viewed Marcus Garvey as a threat to his own leadership standing, but more broadly as a threat to the race and racial progress, because he viewed Garvey as essentially a demagogue. He was very turned off by his flamboyance, but also viewed his financial management, or mismanagement, we might say, of the UNIA as a threat and ultimately an embarrassment to the race. So they engaged in a very heated and at times very personal war of words throughout much of the early 1920s.
You gave the reader a glimpse into the family life of Dr. Du Bois in terms of his daughter being engaged. Tell us about that.
Du Bois, I think it's fair to say, was not the best husband and certainly not the best father. His daughter, Yolande, who was born after the death of his firstborn son, was always seeking her father's attention and love and support. But Du Bois, busy at the time with leading the race, editing the crisis, writing books, organizing Pan-African congresses, did not devote the necessary time and attention and love to her that she needed. And that was reflected in her personal life and her own personal relationships. She became engaged to County Cullen, who at the time was one of the star poets in Black America and during the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s. They ultimately married in Harlem during a very elaborate wedding ceremony, but they were not compatible as a pair, something that Du Bois, Yolande's father, didn't really seem to pay much attention to. He was more concerned about what their marriage, what their union would represent in terms of the progress of the race and their own family lineage. And Yolande and County Cullen ultimately divorced.
Now, Dr. Du Bois had so much information that was sent to him by the soldiers. How did he deal with all of that information?
One of the key parts of Du Bois's relationship that I explore in my book, The Wounded World, was with Black soldiers and Black veterans in particular. As I said, he formed a very close relationship with many men. They were the ones who provided him with the majority of the materials that he would use in trying to write his book, which he titled The Black Man and the Wounded World. They provided him with letters, diaries, all types of documents. And they believed that Du Bois was going to tell their story. They believed in Du Bois, in giving him their personal materials, that he was going to set the historical record straight, that he was going to refute the racist lies that were being spread about them. So they invested their hopes and historical visions in Du Bois, and Du Bois felt personally responsible for telling their story of writing their history. But over the years, as Du Bois struggled to write his book, as time went on, many of these men asked Du Bois for their materials back. And by and large, he refused to return their materials to them. He believed that they were better off in his hands, that he would eventually complete his book. And many of those materials still to this day remain in the archive that I used as one of my main sources for writing my book.
Let's move now to the 70th birthday of Dr. Du Bois. What did he say that was so memorable about his life?
On the occasion of Du Bois' 70th birthday, his friends and colleagues at Atlanta University threw an elaborate celebration for him. And he spoke on the evolution of his life and the evolution of his political program, using this as an opportunity to reflect on the various key stages in his life, one of those being the First World War. And in that speech at the Atlanta University Chapel, he remarkably admits to his confusion and his regret in supporting the war. And this is really reflective of how Du Bois wrestled with the failure of the war itself and the ultimate failure of his decision to support it. Du Bois was deeply wounded by the war, and that speech that he gave on the occasion of his 70th birthday really reflected the depth of his wounds.
November 23rd, 1944, the letter from Atlanta University. What happened?
The letter from Atlanta University.
When he was retired.
When he was retired, of course. Du Bois, he returned back to Atlanta University after he left the NAACP in the early 1930s. He went back to Atlanta University to resume his career as a teacher, as a scholar. He basically didn't get along with the president of Atlanta University, as well as the president of Morehouse. He was very unceremoniously retired to his surprise. And this left him in a very precarious position financially, but also in terms of his ability to continue his scholarly work and to advocate on the behalf of the race. Eventually returns back to the NAACP after he's retired from Atlanta University. But that was a very jarring moment for Du Bois and one that he would look back on with a great deal of bitterness.
Now, he was 76 years old when he went back to the NAACP. And a lot of things started to happen. His most famous friend, James Weldon Johnson. What happened to him that devastated Dr. Du Bois?
Du Bois and James Weldon Johnson had a very long, very close personal relationship and friendship. And very tragically, James Weldon Johnson dies in a car accident. And this affected Du Bois on a very deep personal level. Again, James Weldon Johnson being one of his closest friends and one of his biggest supporters when it came to the writing of his book. And this was yet another moment in the long disillusionment that Du Bois would experience in the aftermath of the war, you know, all the way through the years encompassing World War II as well. It was a tragic blow for Black America, but also a very tragic blow for Du Bois personally.
World War II and African Americans. What was Du Bois's reaction to the war?
Du Bois saw World War II coming. In 1936, Du Bois traveled overseas, and he spent several months in Germany in the summer of 1936, where he witnessed Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich up close. He also travels through the Soviet Union and spends time in China as well as in Imperial Japan. And during this six-month journey, when he's in Europe and in Asia, he sees with his own eyes the seeds of a possible Second World War on the horizon. And he returns back to the United States in late 1936. And by early 1937, he is advocating anybody who would listen, right, to take these warning calls seriously, and using the book that he was trying to write and trying to publish as an example of what can happen when war is not taken seriously. All right, so he sees his book, The Black Man and the Wounded World, as a potential opportunity, a last gasp opportunity to warn the world about the horrors of modern warfare. And very tragically, no one listens. He gives up hope that he is ultimately going to finish his book. And by 1940, when he does decide that he is no longer going to continue to write The Black Man in the Wounded World, the Second World War has erupted. Du Bois is very cynical about the outcomes of the Second World War. He believes that there is going to be no positive outcome in it. He views it as an even greater tragedy than the First World War. And even when the United States enters the war and African Americans are forced because of the draft and the pressures of the war to support the war effort, he believes that African Americans didn't have democracy before the war, and they certainly weren't going to have it afterwards as well.
Peace Information Center. Tell us about that center and how Du Bois was connected with it.
The Peace Information Center was a short-lived, very small organization made up of Du Bois and just a couple of other individuals. And their principal goal was to promote peace and to publicize different movements and spread information about peace movements, which were becoming more active in the aftermath of World War II, and as the atomic arms race began to heat up. The Peace Information Center was immediately persecuted by the federal government. They disbanded. But even despite them disbanding, the United States government and the Justice Department charges them with a federal crime of essentially being a mouthpiece for the Soviet Union, and charges Du Bois personally with being an agent of a foreign principal. And this is really a remarkable moment. 83 years old, Du Bois is on trial by the federal government, facing years in jail. And it's really a testament to the remarkable journey that Du Bois experiences from the First World War to the 1950s, right? As I chronicle in my book, where Du Bois, during this time, is reckoning with the legacies of the war, his own commitments to peace. So by 1951, right, he is an ardent peace activist, right? An ardent peace activist. He's ultimately acquitted, but that moment of literally fighting for his life and freedom really put a tragic exclamation point on Du Bois's reckoning with the history of the war and the history of democracy in the United States.
Now, in your book, you talk about the fact that he became a candidate for the Senate with the American Labor Party. And then you talk about the death of his wife of 55 years. Tell us about those events.
Du Bois, he had a short-lived career as a political candidate. He was put up for Congress didn't win, obviously, but he still enjoyed the experience. He received more support than he initially expected. That was just one event that shaped Du Bois's later years. Another event being the tragic death of his first wife, Nina Du Bois. They had a very long, not a very loving marriage, but certainly the death of his first wife was very sad for Du Bois, but he would continue to soldier on.
You talk about he married again to Shirley Graham, and I'm thinking he was about 83. Tell us about that story.
Shirley Graham Du Bois was a really remarkable scholar, intellectual, artist in her own right. Du Bois and Shirley Graham had a long relationship before they formally married. She was one of his biggest supporters. And following the death of Du Bois's first wife, she really stepped in to fill the emotional void, but also support him in his later years, but to also shape his political and intellectual trajectory as Du Bois became more closely aligned with the radical left. Shirley Graham played a very important role in Du Bois's radicalism in the final years of his life.
90th birthday.
Du Bois's 90th birthday. He lived a very long time. And even in old age, even when he was 90 years old, he was still fighting for Black freedom and equality. This was a time when Du Bois was still continuing to be persecuted by the federal government. He was essentially persona non grata during the height of the McCarthy era. But he continued to believe in the values of freedom of speech. He was committed to democracy, even as the United States itself, in persecuting him, revealed its lack of commitment to democracy.
And his death, August 27, 1963.
Du Bois dies in Ghana. August 27th, 1963, he makes the decision to leave the United States in 1961 for Ghana. His passport is eventually restored after it had been taken away by the federal government. He travels abroad to the Soviet Union, to China, to other places in Europe. But when he receives an invitation from Kwame Nkrumah to come to Ghana to finish work on one of his long outstanding projects, Encyclopedia Africana, he accepts the invitation and he realizes that this is, given his age, most likely going to be a final move. He spends his final years in Ghana and dies peacefully in his sleep the evening of August 27th, 1963, literally the day before the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in Washington, D.C.
What is the message you want the reader to leave with once they finish your book?
My book, The Wounded World, is really a story about Du Bois, arguably the greatest Black intellectual in American history, and his reckoning with the personal and historical legacies of the First World War. I really tell a remarkable story in this book about Du Bois's unfinished and unpublished book, which no scholars before me have written about. It's a remarkable glimpse into Du Bois's life, his work, the significance of World War I in his political and intellectual evolution. But ultimately, the reader will take away from my book the broader meanings of democracy for Black people in the 20th century, and how Du Bois was a central figure in those struggles.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. Can you tell the audience the next project you'll be working on?
The next project is still to be determined. I would certainly like to continue working with Du Bois and maybe trying to find a way to get parts of, if not all of, his unfinished manuscript published in some way, shape, or form. I'm also interested in thinking about some of our current debates and controversies regarding African-American studies. And I'm sure even in that project, Du Bois will somehow figure in it.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. And again, we've been talking with Dr. Chad L. Williams, the author of The Wounded World, W.E.B. Du Bois, and the First World War. Thanks again.
Thank you.